Well, thank you everyone for coming. We're delighted to have you here for one of the first Indonesia events that we've had in a long while. And we're particularly delighted to have Professor Dewi Fortuna Anwar, who is one of the leading scholars and practitioners of Indonesian foreign policy, and somebody who has a long association, not just with Australia, but with Indonesian foreign policy more generally. We're also delighted to have the governor, David Hurley, who I've just learned is studying Indonesian and impressed us earlier with his knowledge of Bahasa Indonesia. So thank you, Governor, for attending the event as well. I was wondering if we could begin, Ibu Dewi, by speaking a little bit about the bilateral relationship. We just released a poll yesterday, and feelings among Australians toward Indonesia are at about 58 degrees, which is the highest they've ever been. It's still not particularly high compared to Anglophone democracies or Western democracies, but it's quite high compared to past results. And 9 in 10 Australians said that they regard Indonesia as important or very important to Australia. Would we get the same result if we asked Indonesians if they thought Australia was important to them?
Aaron, that is a trick question. Firstly, I would say, you know, thank you very much for inviting me here, and it's lovely to be at the Lau Institute. We met a number of times, and I read Lau's surveys, and I know a lot of people from Malawi, but this is the first time that I've actually come to a Lau event, not because of lack of invitation from Malawi, but because it's just not easy to come time. Now, I've come here because I was at the Crawford Leadership, Australia Leadership Forum, where Anthony was also there, and so just came back, came for things this morning, so it's lovely to be here. The question is, would the attitudes of Indonesians be similar to what Australia, you know, if a survey had to be done? Firstly, I don't think that survey would ever be done, so I can't see anybody paying. I mean, doing a survey is expensive, right? And I cannot see anybody actually paying that amount of money to do a survey about attitude. And in fact, not many have done. There have not been any survey in Indonesia about any other countries. So it's not just about Australia. As far as I know, that most of the surveys are related to domestic issues. So this is probably a reflection of Indonesia is very active regionally, globally, and so on. But when it comes to surveys, usually it's about the electability of particular candidates, because that's where money is. And surveyors, you know, they only do that. But on the whole, there's never been any strong passion about Australia. There's a general like, you know, Indonesians in general like Australia. A lot of Indonesians would like to study in Australia. A lot of young Indonesians like to study Australia. They like to come to Australia for holiday. They know of Australia as a developed country, it's a rich country, and so on. But unfortunately, also in the past, the East Timor issue, of course, you know, really brought the relations to its lowest point. So there was a very, just as here, the relations, the attitudes towards Indonesia really went down. The attitudes of Indonesians towards Australia, that mostly in the past, the complaint from here is not that Indonesia was not being nice to Australia. The complaint mostly was that Indonesia is not paying sufficient attention to Australia. And the complaints in Indonesia is that Australia was too focused on Indonesia, while Indonesia didn't really got that, you know, that is something that we needed to pay too much attention to, because Indonesia's focus is more towards China, towards the US, and so on. But that 99 incident really, you know, broke relations down, and you know, there was a boycott of Australian products. But after that, relations have moved up with the Bali bombing. I think that was really the beginning of the improvement in the relations between the two countries, particularly as Indonesian police and the Australian police and the intelligence community work very well together. And in fact, the capture of a number of the perpetrators, like Imam Samudra and so on, you know, was because of this close cooperation between the Indonesian police and the Australian, particularly in the technology, you know, the wire, the phone tapping, that was an Australian technology at the time. So things improved, and then we had the tsunami, and Australia was one of the first countries that came to our Indonesian assistance and gave with your full heart and everything. So things have moved up with that. But because we are neighbors, we are always things happening that's beyond the control of government. You have the case of Chappelle Corby that seems to define relations for a long time. People here seem to focus very much on that. The media played it up all the time. The Bali, the Bali Nine, and then the execution of drug traffickers that also brought relations to another breaking point. And then here from the Indonesian sides, there's a lot of Indonesia was very unhappy with the turn back the boat and the incidents near Indonesian territorial waters, for example. So there are always issues that will always come up. So if you ask me at this moment, what are the bilateral relations like? They are at the best ever. There are personal relations between the Prime Minister and President Joko Widodo. They did a great photo opportunity at Tanah Abang. There's nothing wrong that seems to be happening at the moment. So I've mentioned to our ambassador this morning, be careful, things are too nice. Because usually things can happen, but as I said, but it's the nature, the fact that we are neighbors, we have so much in common in terms of geostrategic interests, geoeconomic interests. We are all democracy, a pluralistic society. Our economy are not competitive with each other. We are complementary with each other. We have so much going, but we are also so very, very different, and there will always be misunderstandings, So.
We published a book last year by Ken Ward, a former Australian intelligence analyst, that argued that to some extent the relationship might be condemned to crisis, that issues like this, like the executions, like the export of beef, that those would always be irritants in the relationship, and that in fact, rather than trying for a best friend relationship, we should lower our sights and try for a more sustainable and steady relationship. Do you think that's possible, or do you think there's a role for aspiration in the relationship?
Well, I mean, Dick will send that. Yeah, I don't think you should romanticize foreign policy. Yeah, at the end of the day, it's interests, and they are the ones that are permanent. Of course, we could try to work on the emotional side of it, but the downside of emotion is that your emotions can go up, it goes down as well. But the interest will always be there. And I think that the most important thing is rationality in relationship. So do not have unrealistic expectations. Because look at it, Indonesia is quite used to prickly relations with our two other closest neighbors, Malaysia and Singapore. Malaysia and Singapore are our closest partners within ASEAN. We are joined together at the hips. But by God, if you are to ask to do a survey in Indonesia, they would like Australians more than they like Singaporeans and Malaysians, because a lot of the Indonesian maids are in trouble. They suffer from human rights abuses at the hands of their employers. A number of them have been executed. The Singaporeans hate Indonesians because of a recent fire. If you talk to the taxi driver, the relations is defined by the haze. Indonesians don't like Singaporeans because it's considered to be opportunistic. It takes advantage of Indonesia's economic troubles. Remember, during the economic crisis, a lot of the money and a lot of Indonesian economic criminals just went to Singapore and sometimes did interview in an Orchard Road hotel. And there's nothing that the Indonesian government can do. Unlike with Australia, we don't have an extradition treaty with Singapore. And it's still not, we're still having, it's a major problem. So, if you live in neighboring countries, with neighbors, there will always be difference. I grew up in England. I mean, just ask an average English person what they think of the French, and they about the Germans, So that I think that's just the nature of it. We like the Brazilians in the past, but of course the Brazilians don't like us because Indonesia executed, one of the. Drug traffickers as well. So it's, if you're neighbors, you'll always be having problems. If you look at East Asian countries, where are the neighbors who really like each other? The Thais don't like the Vietnamese. The Cambodians don't trust the Thais and the Vietnamese. The Thais don't like the Malaysians because I think that Malaysians support the, you know, the Southern Philippines one. We have no problem with the Philippines. We've never had any problems with the Philippines because there's not so much going on in the past with the Philippines. South Koreans don't like the Japanese don't like the Chinese, and vice versa. You know, that is the reality of the region. So I think we just need to be much more hard-headed about it. But of course, the feelings are important. The weakness, you know, the commonality is much easier for Indonesia and Australia now to develop a sense of commonality because Indonesia is a democracy. While in the past, you know, it was very difficult for Australia to have very warm and cuddly feeling about, you know, an authoritarian regime. And Indonesia as a democracy also begin to understand the complexity of the Australian society that, hey, you know, unlike under Suharto period where it controlled the media, the Australian government would like to control the media, but it can't. You know?
One of the things you mentioned several times were the executions, and not just the executions last year, but also Malaysian executions of Indonesian domestic workers, which has become a big political issue in Indonesia. I think many Indonesians would say that this is not a foreign policy issue. This is a domestic issue, an issue of Indonesian law and order. But clearly it became an issue in the relationship. And I'm curious, the Attorney General has said that after Ramadan, Indonesia will resume executions, that there might be 15 after Ramadan, 30 next year. There are no Australians in the list of executions. There are no Australians on death row in Indonesia right now. But this may continue to be an irritant. First, how reliable are Presetio's announcements when it comes to scheduled executions? Because it seems sometimes he announces executions, but then they don't happen. And then second, you know, to what extent should Australia and Indonesia have conversations about capital punishment, not just in Indonesia, but also in the region more generally? Is that offensive to Indonesians to make this a foreign policy issue?
Well, until we change the criminal code where death penalty is still, you know, acceptable, you know, as the form of punishment, then I think that the government will continue to carry death penalties for serious criminal offences, drug trafficking, terrorism, premeditated murder, and now sex offenders. In fact, you know, there is a very popular public support for a new law is now being tabled in Parliament. The government has already issued the PERPU, that's a law, a regulation in lieu of law, which of course has to go to Parliament. Because of this horrendous incidents, so many incidents of gang rape of children, you know, little girls. So there's a public outcry. And in fact, the public demanded that, you know, the highest punishment should be given to them. The controversy is not about the death penalty, but about the, making with it kabiri, that's the castration. Yeah, the castration. The doctors are saying that, you know, they're not going to do it. Nobody protested about the death penalty, but it's rather about the castration issue. So the death penalty is still something that the Indonesian general public support. And when you try to revise a law which is contrary to general public, you know, it's usually that it's not going to be easy. But there are also growing elements within Indonesian society that argues that the death penalty is not really an effective deterrent to crimes. And now you can look at countries that carry out death penalties and whether you see that the crime rate is lower than in countries that do not practice death penalty. Maybe you just go to the United States, you know, is criminal offences less in Texas than in Massachusetts, for example? Yeah, but that is still a conversation that is going. Eventually, Indonesia will probably, you know, try, while not completely banning death penalty, it will again be much more selective. Because under the 10 years of SBY administration, there are not that many people who are executed, despite the fact that the death penalty stipulation is there. But because the Jokowi administration, during his campaign, he made it very clear that he was going to be very vigorous in upholding rule of law and engage, you know, declaring an all-out war on drug trafficking, for example, because this is considered to be a real crisis in Indonesia. There is a widespread widespread public support. Of course, it makes it very difficult for Indonesia when it has to appeal to the king of Saudi Arabia or to the government of Malaysia not to execute Indonesian citizens. But then one of the responsibility of the government and also, you know, one of the priorities of Indonesian foreign policy under Pak Jokowi is protection of Indonesian citizens overseas. So it has to do that, but it understands that it has to do the best that it can, providing lawyer and giving financial assistance, and in Saudi Arabia, for example, paying the diat, the blood money. It does what it can, but it understands that it's within the domestic competence of that particular country. There will always be protests also from the people. I mean, there will be the huge demonstrations in front of a Malaysian embassy or huge demonstrations in front of a Saudi embassy. Mm. But, you know, that's the reality of international relations. You know, the government does what it has to do. But it doesn't see that as a contradiction to its own policy at home. And secondly, about press, is the Attorney General reliable in this? Frankly, my own feeling, you know, you can call it, personally, I'm against the death penalty because I don't really believe that that is an effective deterrence to crime. My husband believes in the death penalty, so we have an interesting argument at home. So, you know, and each side has its own viewpoint. But I believe that one should not make it into a circus. This totally, that is insensitive and unacceptable. So many countries carry out death penalty without having this brouhaha, you know, and having it into turning it into a reality show. Sure. And I think that is what needs to be given sufficient attention to, that it is painful enough without making it into a reality show. And I think that is what is that I openly criticize.
You mentioned earlier that many Indonesians, particularly at a higher level, don't agree with the death penalty. In fact, your former boss, President Habibie, recently came out in opposition to the death penalty. And in almost every country where the death penalty has been abolished, there has been a decision taken by elites, really in advance of popular opinion, swinging against the death penalty. Do you see any chance that Indonesian elites might seek to ban the death penalty or to limit the number of crimes that the death penalty applies to, partly because of foreign pressure, but perhaps also partly just as a result of, you know, your own judgment?
Well, if England, that used to hang somebody for stealing chicken, you know, can become, you know, this humanitarian society, yeah, sure, why not?
Fair enough.
Yeah. But I said it will be. It's not something that's going to be easily achieved, because there are a lot of people who believe that punitive punishments are the way to do it. It's not just about rehabilitation, but punishing somebody, you see? So the concepts of penitentiary, some believe that if you send somebody to prison, it's in order to re-educate, you know, to rehabilitate. But there are other concepts, you know, you make them pay. You know, this is a very Old Testament type of things, you know.
Speaking of making people pay, I wondered if we could speak a little bit about the headlines over the last 5 days with regard to tensions between Indonesia and China. And just to sort of give the audience some background in case you haven't been following it very carefully, the Chinese Nine Dash Line overlaps with the Indonesian Exclusive Economic Zone. And in the last, on Saturday, there was a Chinese fishing vessel that was arrested in the Indonesian Exclusive Economic Zone. Apparently shots were fired, warning shots. The Chinese say someone was injured. Indonesians say that that was not the case. But this is the third time in the last 3 months that there have been incidents in the South China Sea, in the Natuna Sea, near Indonesia's Natuna Islands, between China and Indonesia. Indonesia has always claimed that it is not a claimant in the South China Sea because it doesn't claim any of the land features or reefs. But clearly there is some issue between Indonesia and China now. What will Indonesia do to protect its sovereignty and its fisheries in that area?
Well, as you know, one of the focus of the current government is the maritime area. Well, Indonesia is an archipelago state. And we have always said, you know, Wawasan Nusantara, it's a unity of land and waters. And Indonesia is the one that really pushed for UNCLOS 1982. So the recognition of the archipelago state, so that before UNCLOS 1982, if you know, each island is in fact separated, only had about 12 miles, and then the rest of that would be international waters. So Indonesia, prior to UNCLOS, would be geographically fragmented in terms of its maritime control. Now with UNCLOS, Indonesia controls all of the internal waters plus the 12 miles from the outermost islands, and then the rights over 200 miles of the ZEE that is guaranteed by UNCLOS. And the nine dashed lines impinges on Indonesian's ZEE. The exclusive zone of resort on the Natuna. So when the Chinese map that came out with that dotted line was first published in the 1990s, the Indonesian Foreign Minister Ali Alatas actually wrote a formal letter to the Chinese Foreign Minister to seek a formal clarification. He never got it. But Ali Alatas then met with the Foreign Minister and then sought clarification, and the only answer from the Chinese at the time was, we don't have any problems. You know, we don't have any, you know, Indonesian and China doesn't have overlapping claims. And the nine dash line doesn't exist in UNCLOS. It doesn't have any international status. Therefore, the Indonesia's assertion that we do not have overlapping claims with China stands correct, because that area belongs to Indonesian ZEE according to UNCLOS.
Clearly, though, somebody has forgotten to tell Chinese fishermen about this.
So then this rather assertive pursuance, because the Chinese fishermen are always escorted by Chinese coast guards. So the incident happens, if it's just about a Chinese fisherman being caught by the Indonesian Maritime Fisheries Authority for illegal fishing, that is no major issue, because on any single day, the Maritime and Fishery Authority acts against Thai fishermen, Vietnamese fishermen, Taiwanese fishermen, Japanese fishermen. And these are just simple law enforcement issues, because one of Indonesia's priorities, of course, you know, protecting and is managing its maritime resources. Maybe I can just briefly mention about this maritime focus. It contains five components. The first is ensuring the unity in the archipelago through enhancing connectivity, because it's very difficult, especially with the eastern part of Indonesia. The country may be politically united, but economically it's still very fragmented because of this, you know, geographical reality and difficulty of transportation and so on. So the primary emphasis is improving the maritime connectivity. That means shipping, ports, and so on. Secondly, it's managing and protecting Indonesian maritime resources. That's mean fishing and also mineral rights and so on. Third, it's maritime security and defense. So enhancing Indonesia's capacity to protect its territorial integrity and so on. The fourth is maritime diplomacy. That means also delineating the boundaries and speeding up the negotiations to delimit the boundaries, because there are at least with 10 different countries that, you know, we still have problems in our maritime boundaries. So and because of unclear boundaries, that's what happens when fishermen sometimes are not sure whether they're, you know, in each other's boundaries. And there you need to be able to discuss with each other whether this is illegal fishing or not. And fifth, developing maritime culture, for example. Now, so coming to the illegal fishing, it is very much, you know, a priority. The problems with the Chinese is that I don't think that this is just about a fishing issue, because the Coast Guard has been escorting them. And in the second incident, when Indonesian authority, law enforcement, tried to tow the boat, the Chinese Coast Guard rammed the boat. Yeah, and this time, something nearly similar happens. Indonesia doesn't see it as a territorial dispute. So it still sees it simply as, you know, a law enforcement issue, not as a sovereignty issue. We emphasize that, you know, we have good relations with China, we respect each other, etc. But this is a law enforcement issue. The Chinese have complained because they say this is their traditional fishing rights, which traditional fishing rights can be respected, but illegal fishing is something else, you know.
Well, and on Monday, for the first time, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said that there were overlapping maritime interests with Indonesia, which it seemed like an escalation. It seemed like they were trying to wreck the Indonesian position that there isn't a dispute. Yeah, they were trying to argue that there was a dispute. Why would China do that? It seems as though they're provoking Indonesia, which has actually sought to be a very good friend to China on issues.
Well,
like
I think
this.
That question should be addressed to the Chinese, but because we don't see, I think it doesn't make sense for China to alienate Indonesia, because Indonesia has always stand very neutral on the South China Sea. Indonesia sees itself as a good officer. Indonesia doesn't have any claims in the Spratlys or in the Paracels, and Indonesia has always tried to emphasize that everybody must abide by the UN conventions on the law of the sea, to refrain from the use of force, and to focus on a peaceful settlement of disputes. And even if you don't have, in the South China Sea, I don't think you can really resolve the disputes in any given, in the short time. But you must be able to manage disputes so that it doesn't open up into a major flashpoint. But before you ask me that, because there's certain issues that I like to
sure, please.
Yeah. Because rather than going straight into Q&A, I don't know, have you had any foreign policy lecture lately here?
On Indonesian foreign policy? Not recently.
No, okay, so it might be worthwhile because with the new administration, we need to be able to see, you know, where changes are have been happening and where there have been continuity. Now, maybe briefly to cast back to the SBY period, under President SBY, his concern at the time, if you remember, he came in 2004, between 1997 and 2004, Indonesia was still more or less in a crisis. Indonesia's international image was badly damaged, first by the multiple crises happening within the country, then you have the East Timor issues, then you have the communal conflicts and so on and so on, and then you have the Bali bombing. So there is this feeling that we needed to do something serious, not just managing the country internally, but also projecting a new international image to see that Indonesia has really changed. So that was the focus of Indonesia's foreign policy. Image building became a very important element, not just for prestige or pencitraan, but also to ensure that the international community will understand that Indonesia is now changing. That Indonesia is becoming a democracy. Indonesia is a country where, Pak SBY said, it's a country where Islam, democracy, and modernity goes hand in hand, and did a serious efforts to court good friendly relations with all countries. So the tagline was 1,000 friends, zero enemies, or even 1,000,000 friends, zero enemy. Also, when a time when there was increasing competition between the United States and China, Indonesia wanted to ensure that ASEAN could become a real regional driver to ensure that there was a dynamic equilibrium, so no one country dominating the region. So each of the major powers should be able to counterbalance each other so that through Indonesia and ASEAN, Indonesia was chair of ASEAN 2011, you know, that's very serious efforts to ensure this good balancing. The leadership in ASEAN was also very critical during the SBY period, both under Pak Hasan Wirayuda and under Pak Mati. And Pak SBY himself was an internationalist. He's very comfortable in playing the global stage. He's very good. He speaks very good English, and he is comfortable with big concepts. Both of his foreign ministers also, Pak Hasan Wirayuda and Pak Mati, both with PhDs and highly intelligent intellectual, they're thoughtful thinkers. So that informed Indonesian foreign policy during this time. Democracy became a major public diplomacy issue as well, with the Bali Democracy Forum and promoting democracy, particularly in the region, and projecting this Indonesian image as a country of moderate Islam. Interfaith dialogue also became very important, particularly in the wake of the terrorist attacks. And then enhancing Indonesia's role in the global security activities, like Indonesia is ambitious to become a top 10 true contributing country to the UN peacekeeping operation, for example. In fact, Indonesia has just established a UN peacekeeping center in Indonesia. At the moment, we have 4,000 PKO being posted, less than 4,000. But, you know, there's an ambition that it will go up to 4,000. At the moment, it's 2,000 something. So very regionally active, very globally active. And it succeeded in transforming Indonesia's image. Indonesia is seen as a leader in ASEAN, is seen as an important regional player within the wider East Asian community, is seen to be a global player. Indonesia is a member of the G20 and so on and so forth. So when Jokowi came, was stood up for presidency, and as usual, there is always an attempt by a candidate to define himself from his predecessor, especially if he comes from a different party. If Jokowi had come from a Democratic Party, from the coalition of SBY, maybe his campaign would not have been to distinguish himself from the past, but maybe to continue, meneruskan. But now it is to distinguish himself from the past. So there were these criticisms that the 10 years of the SBY foreign policy was, we got a lot of credits, but where's the beef? We do not really get any real economic benefits from the diplomatic gains. So there's a lot of criticism that the foreign policy was too oriented towards image building and not down to earth enough. So that was the tagline, was that Jokowi would promote a more pragmatic, down to earth and people oriented foreign policy, where foreign policy would benefit the people. So that was the tagline. Now, we'll just have to see whether he has confined himself to that. Now, at the same time, because Jokowi is supported by the PDIP, it has adopted this very Sukarnoist rhetoric as well. So officially it says, Indonesia will again promote this Sukarnoism of Trisakti, the three sacred principles of Merdeka secara politik, political sovereignty. Mandiri secara ekonomis, economic self-sufficiency, self-reliance. Berkepribadian secara budaya, cultural distinctiveness. So if you look at that, you would have thought that, okay, what does it mean? After global engagement, regional engagement, you say, you have to be much more pragmatic, but at the same time, we have to be vigorously protective of our political sovereignty. And economically, we have to be mandiri, self-reliant. What does it mean when there are regional integration, FTAs, and so on, and cultural distinctiveness? So you can see that there are aspirations, but there are realities also. And during the early days when foreign policy was formulated to go with this more pragmatic, down-to-earth foreign policy, but ignoring the Trisakti. So the Trisakti about this political sovereignty and particularly the economic self-sufficiency were given a lot of attention at the domestic level, but when it comes to regional and global level, it's something else. Then there was this argument that in order to carry out this more pragmatic and down-to-earth foreign policy, then first, and instead of having this 1 million friends, zero enemies, it will be more selected bilateral and regional engagements. So it will be much more calculating, put it that way. Focus more on economic issues. Then the maritime dimension is also emphasized. But at the same time, there's also the Indonesia role as a middle power. So firstly, you have the Sukarno rhetorics, but I've argued elsewhere that in implementation, it's more Suharto.
So Jokowi is more Suharto than Sukarno, even though the rhetoric is
The rhetoric is very nationalist, but the implementation, because it's down to earth, people oriented, it has to serve the economic benefits. We have select engagements with key bilateral partners and regions, which would yield immediate benefits to Indonesia. That sounds like Suharto's new order government, particularly in the first 20 years. So that's one point that need to be underlined. We can discuss it more later.
Sure.
And then in the Nawacita, it talks about the maritime identity,
The Nawacita being...
The nine aspirations, yeah.
That Chakoi set out when he was running for election.
Yeah, that's all the motherhood and apple pie, you know, protecting sovereignty and so on. Yeah. But the new element there is the maritime identity that is very clearly stated. The others is, of course, you know, Indonesia's is a democracy, good governance, but also developing from the periphery, so more attention towards the regions, and then rule of law. But the really new issues here is the maritime identity, and secondly, this revolusi mental, new patriotism, bela negara, you know, that kind of things, you know, this vigorous nationalism again. And that is more a response to what is happening in the country, you know, this revolusi mental, because increasing prevalence of first ethno-nationalism, you know, this consciousness of local identity, but also this anti-Pancasila attitudes for some that espouse the caliphate, for example.
So anti-secular.
Yeah, so this is addressing what is it to be an Indonesian. Indonesia is unity and diversity, Bhinneka Tunggal Ika. So that is also being emphasized.
Yeah.
But let's, in terms of the foreign policy, you know, this maritime identity I've already mentioned, but the tagline is that President Joko Widodo wants to make Indonesia into a global maritime fulcrum, you see? Yeah, and so both as the gateway and the gatekeeper. The gateway because Indonesia is there in the middle between the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean. So you have to pass, you know, all ships have to pass through Indonesian waters in order to traverse from the Pacific Ocean to the Indonesian Ocean. So Indonesia doesn't want simply to be ignored, you know, and not to benefit from this being at the crossroads of this very lucrative sea roads, as well as ensuring that we are also the gatekeeper. The gatekeeper means that, you know, that in terms of the defense and security, you cannot simply allow all of the major powers, you know, to pass our waters without Indonesia having its a say in the protection of its waters. So this is an important component of the maritime identity. But the foreign ministry has outlined its own priorities to a certain extent for simply outlining, you know, what the president is trying to do, but also picking particular priorities. And it's only picked four particular priorities, namely protecting national sovereignty. That's, of course, it's always at the top of the list, protecting national sovereignty. And then protecting Indonesian national abroad. There you see, protecting Indonesian national abroad is a key issue. So because Indonesia has now around 4 million people overseas. And then economic diplomacy. Now here, this is the emphasis on the economic benefits that should be derived, you know, from Indonesia's foreign policy activities. But it has not ignored Indonesia's foreign policies in terms of image building. This is not included in Nawacita, but in the foreign ministry's priorities, it says enhancing Indonesia's regional and international profile. So that means that, you know, that is...
So you think that's ongoing? Do you think it's at the same level as it was?
So, at the beginning, there was a reluctance, you see? There was reluctance. So at the beginning, you could see tension. But in practice, events have taken over. And this is where I say, you know, about changes and continuity. So the president has determined that we put emphasis on selected bilateral engagements as well as selected regional engagements, and I can read out to you the countries which are considered as top priorities, and for each of this country or region, the president has interestingly and a bit controversially in the beginning assigned a particular cabinet minister to act as a coordinator, not the foreign minister. The foreign minister is supposed to be the supreme coordinator of foreign policy engagements, but then he has assigned a particular cabinet minister to deal with certain countries. So there are these countries: Australia, China, India, Japan, Malaysia, Russia, Singapore, South Korea, the United States, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. So these are the countries or entities. Hong Kong is not a country, it's an economic entity. Indonesia doesn't have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but it is a very important economic partner. So Taiwan merits a special mention and a special minister looking after Taiwan and Hong Kong. Then the regions are ASEAN, Europe, and the Middle East. And as you know, for Australia, Australia is grouped together with Europe. It doesn't get its own minister, sorry. So it's and Europe, all of those dynamic countries in Europe are just grouped together under Europe. And so you can see that the focus is really very much in the Asia-Pacific region. And the one in charge of Australia and Europe is our Trade Minister, Thomas Lambok. I understand that he was here not too long ago. And if you look at ASEAN, Malaysia is singled out. It's coordinated by no less than Coordinating Minister for Maritime Affairs. And Singapore is singled out, coordinated by Coordinating Minister for Political and Security Affairs. And then the rest of ASEAN, i.e. ASEAN minus Singapore and Malaysia, is supposed to be coordinated by another minister. What do these ministers do? Are they taking over the role of the prime minister? The answer is no. What and Russia is coordinated by Ibu Susi Pujianti, the fisheries minister. This minister is supposed to be the go-to person for anybody who has dealings with a particular country. For example, Mr. Lambong is supposed to open his door 24/7 to inquiries from Australian businessmen who want to do business in Indonesia and have trouble. He's the go-to person. So if there are problems that need to be dealt with that Australia needs, beyond, of course, the usual foreign policy issues, beyond the diplomatic issues that will be handled by the foreign minister, all of the other issues could be, you know, will be coordinated by this particular minister, mostly in the economy, investment, marketing, and so on. So this shows you also about the problem in our foreign policy infrastructure. Clearly, the president doesn't have too much confidence in the ability of regular foreign ministry or diplomacy to take care of our economy interests. And precisely because the foreign ministry is not really well manned in terms of the economy interests. Because unlike in the in Australia, where you have DFAT, combinations of foreign trade and foreign affairs, in Indonesia, foreign policy is seen to be very much in the politics and security rather than in the economy areas. And this is what the president has been trying to do. I don't know. I don't want to say whether it's working very well or not. But you know, that was the idea.
Are there questions from the floor? Eve Warburton, here in the second row.
So can I keep you on that last point? Because recently Pak Luhut Panjaitan came to visit ANU and gave a public seminar. And we were all struck by the extent to which the Coordinating Minister for Security, Politics and Law was speaking as though he were a foreign minister. He was covering a lot of issues. It was a really broad seminar. And I think that also speaks to the point that you were just making, that under Jokowi we seem to have a very fragmented infrastructure when it comes to dealing with policy, foreign policy issues, and indeed with trade as well. And we get some rather incoherent messages coming from the government when it comes to the government's approach to attracting foreign investors, what kind of trade deals it wants to engage in. So I know you didn't want to say whether it was working or not, but can you talk a little bit about what you think might be the consequences of this sort of fragmented, dispersed foreign policy infrastructure that we're seeing develop?
Well, there is this concern that in theory, on paper, if you look at the charts, the 10 different ministers overseeing 10 different key relations, and then the top is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But as you know, the Minister of Foreign Affairs actually reports to Coordinating Minister for Political Affairs. So Ibu Retno is, in fact, under the coordination of Pak Luhut. Can you imagine Ibu Retno coordinating Pak Luhut of Singapore, for example? You know, so that's or can the foreign minister, for example, coordinate coordinating minister for maritime affairs? In practice, on paper, the president says yes. You know that we have to do that. But in theory, sometimes you know there are problems. But it is not supposed to be like that because they all have to report to the foreign ministry. They are not supposed to go on their own. So the gatekeeper is still the foreign ministry. The problem is, I think the foreign ministry probably also needs a bit of restructuring because there's no perfect way to do it. In the past, the foreign ministry was restructured based on sectors. So you have Director General for Political and Security Affairs, Director General for Economic Affairs, Director General for Certain Affairs, you know. Then they say, you know, no, that doesn't make sense because, like in the Asia Pacific, politics and economics are so linked together, and you really need to look at it regionally. So they have restructured that to be more like in the US. You have Director General for Asia Pacific and Africa, you know, all the rest. Then the Director General for America and Europe, and then Director General for International Cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. But now the problem is there's no one. When you have to deal, for example, with issues like Chiang Mai Initiative, which Director General would you go to? You go to, of course, you have the Director General for ASEAN, that's okay. But the Director General of ASEAN, the Chiang Mai Initiative is actually under the Ministry of Finance. Because
this is the currency swap arrangement with China and ASEAN countries.
And there's been a time when the finance ministers done their meeting, sometimes not having despite the fact that we have a DG for ASEAN, the DG for ASEAN is not well informed about it. You know, so there are always these problems. So this is a bureaucratic problem. The foreign ministry just needs to have more people who can attend all the different meetings. But when it comes to rather incoherent messages, Indonesia, as you know, is at the moment trying to do both things. At one level, this call for economic self-sufficiency is very, very popular. The Indonesia needs to develop its own economy and less dependent on the outside world. It has to develop more of its value added should be within the country. Indonesia should not be too dependent on food or on beef from Australia, for example. You know, that is a very strong national sentiment about that. And in fact, the President Jokowi don't campaign on that. So he really has to be seen to deliver on that as well. But at the same time, there's a reality that Indonesia lacks resources. Indonesia needs foreign investment. Indonesia needs technical expertise. Indonesia needs to cooperate with other countries. Indonesia doesn't have sufficient food. There's a time of scarcity when we need to import. So when you look at it, you have to be able to go into the details, because you cannot just look at it globally. There are areas where Indonesia, you know, this is really a no-no. It will be in the negative list of investment. But there are other areas where it will be more open. And recently the government has already passed its 12 economic packages, and they are extremely liberal, opening areas to foreign investment. Those that were formerly in negative list have been opened up, but there are still others in the non-negative list. And at the same time, as you know, this economic nationalism, Indonesia at the same time wants to attract as many tourists into the country as well. Tourism is a key priority. So unilaterally, Indonesia has given free visa to 169 countries, including to Taiwan and Israel. That's, I think, that the reality of the pocketbooks, you know, the economic necessity forces the government to be much more flexible. So you have maybe a rather ideological or doctrinal stance on the one hand, but in practice, it's much more flexible than that. And also, during Pak SBY time, when TPP first came about, the GAP president said Indonesia would never join TPP. It's not in our interest. We are more focused on RCEP. And then everybody was surprised when President Joko Widodo announced in Washington that Indonesia would consider joining TPP at one period. The question is not if, but when, you know. So that is a remarkable turnaround in attitude towards this free trade arrangement.
Thank you for your talk. I was particularly interested in your comments on the death penalty. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm concerned about the government's recent announcements that it's planning to resume executions. And up to 15 people are reportedly facing imminent execution, all of whom were convicted of alleged drug offences, which does not meet the threshold of most serious crimes under international law. So how can the government carry out these executions without violating international law and standards? Does this contradict the image that it wants to create for itself on the international stage and attract tourism? And also in relation to your comments on the government's appeals for clemency for Indonesian citizens on death row in other countries, how can they hope to protect Indonesian citizens in other countries long term while they are still carrying out executions in their own country, including of non-Indonesian nationals?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said before, under the Indonesian criminal code, death penalty is still one of the punishments. And as I said, you know, there is a very huge popular support for death penalty for this extraordinary crimes. And for Indonesia, drug trafficking is considered to be a very serious crime. It's not a theoretical threat, it is a real threat, because the number of Indonesians, particularly young, you know, the younger generation, who have been victims of drug trafficking is growing by leaps and bounds. So there is a very strong national sentiment not to be lenient on drug traffickers, but to be lenient to victims. So instead of jailing victims, now there is a move to change the law towards rehabilitations. So you need to be able to really distinguish between victims and traffickers. In the past, everybody was just jailed. So now the Indonesian jail is bursting at capacity. 65% of them are because of drug issues. Indonesia argues that, well, you know, the United States is supposed to be a champion of democracy and it carries death penalty. Many countries still carry death penalties. So then that is the argument that it often puts forward, that despite the prohibition in many countries, there are still some countries and democracies that also still carry a death penalty. Yeah. And I think opinions will change eventually, but it is not going to be due to international pressure, because international pressure tends to be a bit, you might say, double standards quite often. So that is not what is going to sway a country. It will be changing norms and values, and eventually there will be maybe within the criminal law they will not take it out, but in terms of the implementation, they will probably reduce it, you know. But as I said, I mentioned earlier, the death penalty for sex offenders is a new law that is now being debated, because there is a concern that sex offenders tend to get very lenient sentences. Judges, mostly males, you know, tend to be very soft on sex offenders. But after so many horror stories of children, and some of them have been killed, because gang rapes by adult rapists and then killed. After the latest incident, the government actually issued a regulation in lieu of law, rather than waiting for law. Now the law is being debated, and that puts death penalty there. So I'm afraid, you know, that is the public mood at the moment. So when it comes to international image, I say, you know, there are issues when it is really related to what the national core national interest, then it is what was going to determine policy, rather than just not being popular internationally.
My name's Dom Beresford. I have no particular affiliation. Mm. I was very interested in the organisation of foreign implementation of foreign policy, and the fact that Australia is linked with Europe. I'd appreciate a comment on an indication of priorities, or the view, the linking, or the assigning of those portfolios, a reflection on what the government thinks about the particular countries. And
basically, you think that we're all Europeans here. Is that the question?
Yeah, that's an easy and convenient thing that they can lump us together with Europe, but we're all the same sort of people, therefore. Have you got a comment on that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I was looking at that and I was wondering why Australia doesn't get a particular assigned a particular minister, and why it's lumped with Europe. And I think that's an indication that the fact of the matter is that Australia is not a major investor yet in Indonesia. Europe is a larger investor in Indonesia, and maybe it is important enough to get a special attention, but it doesn't merit yet to get its own minister to coordinate it. But the interesting thing is not the fact that Australia is only Australia, but Europe, because UK and France and Germany are major players in the Indonesian economy, but Europe is slumped together because of special relations with EU and so on. Indonesia is in the middle of negotiating an economic cooperation with the EU as well. But yeah, maybe there is still a perception in Jakarta that Australia has more affinity with Europe.
Perhaps as more and more Indonesian students come and study in Australia, as you did, they'll get a different impression of the place. Mm-hmm. Ibu Dewi, thank you so much for coming to the Lowy Institute and for giving us your views on Indonesian foreign policy and the bilateral relationship. I really appreciate it, and I know all my colleagues do as well. Thanks very much.
Thank you.